I'm Marty Moscoe. Welcome to Radio Times. Yesterday, Secretary of State John Kerry, Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel, and General Martin Dempsey, Chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, testified before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee about a proposed military strike against Syria. The Syrian government has been accused of using chemical weapons against civilians in an attack in August. President Obama said he favored a military response and sent a resolution to Congress for their reaction and their input. We begin our conversation, and we have three guests lined up in this hour of Radio Times. We begin with Ed O'Keefe. He covers Congress and politics for The Washington Post, and nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good to be with you, Marty.
I was listening to a lot of yesterday's testimony before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and I thought it was a pretty substantive discussion. What did you hear?
Definitely a substantive exchange of a broad range of opinions that are now shared by lawmakers in different camps. I think there's clearly those that are supportive of this, those that are supportive so long as there are restrictions on what the U.S. military is allowed to do, others much more skeptical and concerned that the U.S. perhaps hasn't exhausted all of its diplomatic options, and others yet still concerned that even if Congress rejects some kind of authorization, that the president will go forth and do this on his own regardless.
But you describe these various camps. Do you think that people are persuadable, or do you think that their minds are already made up?
No, I think in many cases folks are still persuadable. I mean, at this point, what is it, Wednesday? I'm losing track.
Yes, it is.
And you've got
too.
About a week to go probably until a vote on a formal resolution. I think that gives people ample time to not only review the evidence here in Washington, but also to take the temperature of constituents back home and perhaps hear from other groups. And I think there's, genuine conflict, really, in the thinking of a lot of lawmakers. They know that Americans don't want war. They don't want military conflict. They go to the funerals of their constituents who have been killed in Iraq and Afghanistan, or they have to continue pushing the Department of Veterans Affairs to take care of the claims made by veterans returning from those wars who continue to have problems. They also know there are huge budgetary constraints. But yet they know that if the United States does nothing, that perhaps our standing in the world will be compromised. And yet they still think to themselves, well, why should we do this at all? Clearly the world already has issues with the fact that we step in and do these types of things. What if we do it now? Wouldn't that just make us even more unpopular? So for a lot of people, certainly a lot of conflict here, and this issue is not breaking down along predictable partisan or ideological lines at this point. You have libertarians and conservatives joining with urban liberals in the House saying that they're not going to vote for this. In the Senate, you have a mix of Democrats and Republicans saying yes, and a mix of Democrats and Republicans saying maybe.
Looking at this resolution, I don't know if you've seen it or not, but it looks like there is a bit of a pushback, or at least some attempts to try to amend some of the wording in this resolution that came from the White House.
Yeah, as we understand it, this would essentially authorize up to 90 days of military action against Syria, beginning with 60 days at the start, with the option for another 30 if the president gives congressional notification. No U.S. troops would be allowed, no U.S. combat troops, we should say, would be allowed to deploy into Syria. It does leave the door open for the possibility that, let's say, for whatever reason, some kind of small special forces rescue mission had to go into Syria to quickly grab some Americans who were, for whatever reason, in harm's way. But beyond that, no U.S. troops would be physically deployed into Syria. At the same time, the president would have to, within 30 days of approval of this resolution, come up with a diplomatic way to end the violence and the situation that's brewing in Syria. That might be a harder road to hoe, but if that's what they have to do in order to get authorization for military action, it seems the White House might be okay with that. That is what will be debated by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee today. If they get it out either today or as late as Friday, that is what the Senate will then begin debating next week, and then conceivably it could get sent to the House. But over in the House, there are at least a small handful of Democrats working on a similarly limited version of a new resolution, probably in the generally the same vein as the one in the Senate, because the Senate really takes care of the two biggest concerns, and that is sort of establishing some limits on how long this could go on and absolutely restricting the deployment of U.S. combat troops into Syria, plus asking the president for a way to come up with a way to end all this at some point in the near future.
I heard Senator Rand Paul sort of questioning the White House yesterday, basically saying that it looks like the White House is going to do what they want anyway, and questioning what Congress was doing in terms of this whole authorization issue.
That's right. And in fact, that was one of the sharpest and I think most most illustrative exchanges between a lawmaker and a member of the administration, because Senator Paul said, look, I'm thrilled that the president's asking us to do this, but I'm concerned that he hasn't, you know, defiantly laid out what he would do if Congress were to reject this. John Kerry, the Secretary of State, turned around and said, well, look, it's perfectly within his constitutional prerogative to launch a limited military response if he feels it's necessary without congressional authorization, but you, as members of Congress, should authorize this anyway, you know, and we're not trying to take the U.S. into a more classic or conventional war. We're merely trying to, in a very limited way, target a few spots in Syria in response to the use of chemical weapons. But what Senator Paul is reflecting there is a growing concern, not only among libertarian and conservatives like him, but also a good chunk of liberals, especially in the House, who say, you know, why are we wasting our time with this if he may go off and do it anyway?
Well, and do you think the president, by putting the ball slightly in Congress's court, is trying to get them essentially on record and thereby sort of holding them accountable for whatever happens?
I mean, in the crassest sense, anyone could look at it and say that, yes. I think what it also could inevitably demonstrate is the president's view on how military action should be exercised by official Washington. I mean, remember, he was elected in part back in 2008 in response to the handling of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. He had vowed to end both of them. He has, for the most part, ended those conflicts. This is the process of winding down in Afghanistan. And now that he's about to engage U.S. forces again, potentially, he's doing it the way that he would have liked to have seen George W. Bush do it, perhaps in Iraq and to some extent with Afghanistan, though the Afghanistan situation, I think most in Congress would agree, was much more justified, in that they collected the intelligence, they are sharing it in open and in classified briefings with lawmakers. Administration officials are making themselves available for these litany of questions that are being fired off by lawmakers, and there's an open debate underway at the request of the president. And, you know, we'll see, win or lose, what he ultimately decides to do. But let's say conceivably that Congress approves this and then the military strikes occur and the situation at some point exhausts itself, he can turn around and say, that's the way I believe that the White House and Congress should work together when it comes to military action. And in a sense, it'll be a victory for him. Now, of course, if everything falls off the rails, yes, to some extent, blame can be shared between the two. Or the president himself could be put in a corner by lawmakers by saying, you know, you asked us for this, we gave you what you wanted, it's your fault. Whereas he may turn around and say, no, you know, you joined me in this by authorizing it.
Ed, you describe a reluctant Congress, and I think for all the obvious reasons. And reading and listening to the president, it sounds like a reluctant president as well. Do you see it that way?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the administration's made it clear. Nobody's interested in putting U.S. forces in harm's way yet again. No one's interested in exercising military force, but there's a belief that the Assad regime has gone too far and that there must be some kind of consequence. I think John Kerry several times yesterday during the hearing, turning to his colleague Chuck Hagel, reminded their colleagues, former colleagues in Congress, look, we're Vietnam War veterans. We know more than most people the real costs and effects of war. We don't want to do this again, but it has to be done because of what has occurred in Syria. And I think that, you know, depending on how this plays out, this could be a real moment of great credibility, not only for Secretary Kerry, but also for Secretary Hagel, and for President Obama's decision to put them there, because he'll be able to say, look, I put guys who have been to war, who know the consequences of this, in charge of the operations. These aren't people who are willing and eager to do this on a regular basis. They aren't, but we're asking them to do it. And remember, there's great budgetary strain on the Defense Department right now. That is likely to be a factor in all this. That at a time when you're asking forces to pull back, when you're shrinking the size of the Navy, when you're shrinking the size of the Army and the Marines, why would you then go and put a big military operation together? And I think that's a question that the administration will have to tackle at some point.
It's interesting. It looks like John Boehner is in support of what the president wants to do. Nancy Pelosi in support of it as well. It's interesting, as you were saying, to see these people or even camps lining up with each other.
Yeah, you know, because remember, Pelosi was opposed to the use of force authorization back in 2002 with regards to Iraq, but very quickly has put herself well out ahead of many of her House Democratic colleagues. And many here in Washington believe that it's going to fall to her ultimately to twist arms and get enough House Democrats to join with however many Republicans are willing to approve it over there. Boehner being in support of this is notable and is certainly a victory for the White House, but remember that Boehner's had very big problems this year getting Republicans to go along with his agenda. He was unable to get a highway bill passed. He's been unable to get a farm bill through the House. Several other smaller, modest measures regarding health care and the economy have been pulled at the last second because they lacked the sufficient support. So to see John Boehner and Eric Cantor, the majority leader, on board is one thing. But remember, there's a block of about two, three dozen more conservative libertarian House Republicans who are more than willing to buck leadership when necessary if it conflicts with their own views.
Let me ask you about John McCain and Lindsey Graham in the Senate. Both of them, seems like they are calling for more than what the president is calling for in terms of Syria.
They are, but after their meeting with the president at the White House on Monday, they emerged to say, you know, they're reluctantly on board with what he's trying to do here. They are warning that it would be catastrophic for Congress not to support some kind of resolution authorizing military force. But McCain has said since that, you know, the president should have just gone and done it. He has the authorization to do it. He didn't need us, but if he's asking us for it, then we better get on board. I think both of them certainly would have liked to have seen him engage much sooner. They have said it on a pretty fairly regular basis. McCain himself briefly crossed into Syria recently to go visit with some of these rebels. He goes to the region just about every congressional recess opportunity he gets. And I think both him and Graham are very concerned that the U.S. has not been doing more there. Whether they are going to actively rally their like-minded colleagues in the Senate and the House to vote for this, though, remains to be seen. Both of them have made clear it's the White House that has to do the heavy lifting on getting folks to support this.
And how much do you think this issue will bump into the showdown over the debt limit, spending, the Affordable Care Act, other issues that the Congress says it's going to take up when it gets officially back from vacation?
Yeah, last I checked, there are 30 days in September, there are only 9 legislative days on the calendar in the House and the Senate. They come back Monday night. The House will begin debating it then, as will the Senate. Votes will be held at some point during the week. We're not quite sure when, and I think it would be everyone's preference that this get completed in the first full week back there and not necessarily fall into the next week. If it does, yes, you're right, that pushes back consideration of a temporary spending plan to make sure that there's a budget in place at the end of the fiscal year on September 30th to tackle the reauthorization of the Farm Bill, which also expires on September 30th. There are concerns with the Postal Service. Some of the funding that it gets ends at the end of September. Then there's the debt ceiling fight to be had in mid-October. There could be some quick agreement put together where they say, you know what, suddenly, boom, the new deadline is some date in October, and we'll take up all of these issues then, and because of what happened with Syria. And they might not even have to account for some of the costs of Syria in all these negotiations. And then, of course, that also pushes back eventual consideration of immigration reform in the House. There had been promises that that process would begin at some point in September. At this point, I'm guessing it won't happen until mid-October or November.
Well, you will have your hands full, as will Congress. And Ed O'Keefe, as always, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Great to be with you, Marty.
And he covers Congress and politics for The Washington Post, the first of 3 guests in this hour of Radio Times, talking about Syria, as much of the country is talking about. And Michael Doyle waiting in the wings from McClatchy Newspapers. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We'll be talking about some of the legal and constitutional issues related to whatever the U.S. does. And we'll also be talking about nonproliferation. So if any of those issues line up with yours, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Fringe Art supports WHYY and presents the 2013 Fringe Festival September 5th through 22nd, featuring over 150 local and international theater, dance, music, and visual art events in venues across Philadelphia. Spotlight shows include Where We Live by So Percussion, a multi-sensory concert that coaxes music from the work of guest artisans like a violin maker, a metal worker, and a brewmaster who join musicians, dance, theater, and video artists on stage. Tickets at fringearts.com.
The WHYY Connections Festival is back Saturday and Sunday, September 7th and 8th at the Great Plaza on Penn's Landing. Saturday rocks with headliners They Might Be Giants, Ben Queller, and more. And Sunday switches to the sound of Philly Soul with the Soul Survivors, Sensational Soul Cruisers, and again, more. Both days are free and open to the public. The 2013 WHYY Connections Festival. Learn more and register online at whyy.org/connectionsfestival.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, anthropologists were supposed to help the U.S. military win hearts and minds in Iraq and Afghanistan. A reporter says these human terrain teams were working against the odds.
The moment to learn about people in the places where we're fighting is not in the middle of a war.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. The proposed military strike against Syria has raised a long list of legal and constitutional questions about the War Powers Resolution, the UN Charter, the Chemical Weapons Convention, and much, much more. Joining us now is Michael Doyle, national correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers, where he covers legal affairs, the courts, the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Justice Department. And Michael Doyle, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's a real pleasure.
And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I'll ask you the question I just asked Ed O'Keefe. This is to you, Michael Doyle. Did President Obama have the authority to launch a strike against Syrian targets without congressional authorization?
Well, unfortunately, it depends who you ask. The president says, yes, that he has the authority. It's inherent in his capacity as commander-in-chief and in his constitutionally mandated role of protecting and preserving the national security. So he didn't want give away the store in coming to the Congress. The president, like other presidents before him, does maintain he's got a certain inherent authority. Members of Congress always feel second-class citizens in these sorts of affairs, and they will say that for the many of members of Congress, that is to say, that the president really does need congressional authority. It's an open question that has never been firmly resolved.
Do you think it's a linguistic issue, whether we call this a war, a strike, you know, any other sort of euphemism for some kind of an attack?
Well, it's an important point you make. Some will remember the Vietnam War, which was never declared, the Korean War, which was never declared, the war in Grenada. The first Persian Gulf War was authorized, but not formally declared a state of war. The second Gulf War was authorized, but never formally declared a war. And over the course of the decades, the term war itself seems to have lost some of its meaning as they become police actions or so on. But the law does matter. The Constitution is made of words that count, and Congress is given the authority to declare war in the U.S. Constitution, and the U.N. Under the United Nations or under international law, there are only certain types of wars considered legal. And so if you take these things seriously, it's more than of linguistic significance.
I don't know whether you listened to the testimony before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee yesterday. What do you make of it?
Well, I certainly came away thinking that the Senate is going to approve a scaled-back version of war powers. We've seen already today the Senate's rewritten version. Chairman Menendez from New Jersey, the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, has come out with an alternative proposal to the very sweeping, broadly written proposal from the Obama administration. The Senate's version would limit to 60 plus 30 days an authorization. It would rule out ground troops and so on. And the nature of a Senate hearing is you don't really ask questions. You make a statement and then put a question mark at the end of it. And pieced together, there's Senate support. The Senate will definitely pass, in my assessment, war authorization. The trickier question comes today when the House Foreign Affairs Committee has its hearing. Same witnesses, perhaps more skeptical members on the panel.
How much do you think the ghost of the Iraq war, and by that I mean the intelligence failures of that war and even false information about Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction, how much do you think that hangs over the discussion about what the U.S. could or should do in Syria?
Oh, you can hear the clanking of the chains of that ghost. Secretary of State Kerry himself, in his forceful remarks last Friday on the necessity of taking military action, insisted explicitly this is not Iraq, this is not Afghanistan, this is something unique. And so he was trying to mollify concerns that once again faulty intelligence or bad rhetoric has driven the United States into war action. And certainly members of Congress look back at the political fate of people like Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton, who lost the Democratic presidential primary in part because of her vote for the Iraq War was held against her by the Democratic base. So there's a lot of calculations going into the wisdom of this move and how it will play out in the future. The ghost of Iraq is very much a player here.
Do you think even the authorization after September 11th, at least from the perspective of some skeptics in Congress, that gave the executive too much authority because it's an authority that President Obama has been using in strikes against targets in Yemen, for instance?
Yeah, it's an incredibly open-ended authorization, or it's been interpreted in an open-ended way. In the fever, the pain and the rage that the country felt and that Congress expressed after 9/11, lawmakers passed an authorization of military force that was explicitly targeted those who planned and undertook and harbored those who undertook the 9/11 terror attacks. But it remains in force. It's still being used to legally justify the detention of detainees in Guantanamo, strikes in the Philippines, Yemen, in sub-Saharan Africa. It's been very, very widely used. There are some members of Congress who have some concerns about that, and there has been some discussion about whether it needs to be updated or curtailed, although that's taken place at a fairly low level of rhetoric. There's not been a lot of public attention or concern with that way, the very open-ended way that authorization has been utilized.
And that's Michael Doyle. He's a national correspondent for McClatchy. He writes about constitutional and international legal issues, including some recent articles about President Obama's proposed authorization of force against the Syrian government. This is after alleged chemical weapons attack that reportedly left hundreds, maybe more than 1,000 civilians dead, and that would be men, women, and children in a suburb outside of Damascus. What do you think about what the president and what Congress should do? Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Michael, the president had a press conference with the head of Sweden earlier this morning talking about this red line that he mentioned last summer, the red line associated with the use of chemical weapons. But he really was trying to make the case that the credibility of the world is on the line, not just the United States. And I, you know, in terms of I guess the treaties and conventions that we have applied to chemical weapons, how does that play out?
Well, it's an interesting case to make because it doesn't seem to be resonating among the members of the world community. Of course, because Russia and China, permanent members of the United Nations Security Council, a 15-member body, because Russia and China have the veto power, the United Nations has not authorized action. The North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, has not authorized action, as they had done in prior events such as Kosovo. There are very, very few other countries that are willing to participate in military action. Members of the Arab League have denounced use of chemical weapons. Other countries have denounced chemical weapon use by the Syrian regime, and that some have called it a violation of the international rules.
Mm-hmm.
But that rhetorical support has not been followed up by muscular military support. So in the event of the U.S. military action, with the French may come along and there may be some minor logistical aid, it'll be a essentially unilateral action, which raises the question, if this is meant to vindicate the international norms, where's the international community? So I would interpret what President Obama said today as an effort to once more rally an international community that seems to be skeptical of the wisdom of military action.
He used the word lip service, and we're talking about the Chemical Weapons Convention signed or ratified by something like 189 nations, not Syria, but 189 nations.
Well, that's right. There are five nations, including Syria, that have neither signed nor ratified it. Two nations, including Israel, have signed it, but not fully ratified it. The law professors I've talked to say that even though Syria is not a party to the Chemical Weapons Convention, the norm against the international norm against the use of chemical weapons is so entrenched that that one can be said to be in violation of an international norm, even if you haven't agreed to abide by the treaty itself.
Well, I know you're using the word norm, and I hear that coming out of other people as well. A norm meaning what the world will be willing to, I guess, tolerate versus a law or a treaty.
Yes, and of course, because it's not enunciated in black and white letter law as a treaty or a law, but rather it's sort of what people believe, feel, or think. It raises questions about the ability or the authority to enforce a norm. How do you enforce a feeling that one weapon is anathema in the international community and should not be used? Typically, enforcement must follow a legal regime. But as I say, there is some sense, and the Obama administration certainly plays on this sense, that chemical weapons are so reviled in the international community, their use, even by a country that has not formally forsworn their use, should be subject to discipline.
Let me ask you another question, then we'll get to our callers. This has to do with the UN Security Council. Now, they have, I guess, their what they would describe as definitions for how a country can go to war, self-defense being one of them. What else?
Well, that's right. And it's not just the United Nations, but under international law, international norms, if you will, the two ways in which war may be waged legally: one, national self-defense, and the second, if it's been authorized by the UN Security Council. So that puts the United States in quite a bind under international law, where the UN Security Council, for political reasons, in essence, will not authorize this conflict. And even though we hear comments from the administration about the threats to the U.S. national security, by no means can it be reasonably argued that the United States has been actively attacked. This could not be described, I don't think, with a straight face, as an act of self-defense. So there are some who will say that this is technically speaking, an illegal act of war, even if it is, in another sense, legitimate, because it's been authorized by the United States Congress. It's a tricky terrain. One thing that we know from past experience is presidents are typically willing to act first and ask for an apology or ask for forgiveness later, rather than wait for full authority if they think it's in the national interest.
Let me get to our callers. Looks like we have Dale from Lindenburg joining us on Radio Times. Dale, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, thanks. This morning, reports are coming out of the UK that, sure enough, they have okayed exports of two of the chemical precursors of chemical weapons for these things in the last year or so. So just like Iraq, here we are making money. And then say, oh, how dare you guys actually use these things we export to you. It has a familiar and very hollow ring to it.
And Dale, just a quick question. When you say reports out of the UK from the Guardian, I mean newspapers, things like that?
Yeah. I don't think it was the Guardian, but one of the major UK papers, they had okayed the exports of two of them until this past January. I can't remember all the details.
Okay, all right. Well,
it's out there. British multinationals have made their money within the last year selling these chemical precursors to Syria. That's a fact.
Well, I don't know whether, Michael Doyle, you can respond to that or not.
Well, I'll just say that the caller makes an interesting point, and it's observing a gruesome fact, which is that oftentimes the profit motive or geopolitical machinations lead to some behavior that may be seen as immoral. I'm speaking, for instance, of during the Reagan administration, there was not just a blind eye turn toward the Iraqi use of nerve gas or chemical weapons against the Iranians. There was active U.S. military intelligence assistance to Iraq because they were fighting a geopolitical enemy, Iran. And that's a discomfortable thing to realize, that sometimes our own government or our companies may be helping profit or helping facilitate actions that, in hindsight, we come to regret.
Dale, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me ask you something else, Michael Doyle. And this is a phrase I kept coming across, either the duty to protect or the responsibility to protect. It raises questions about the Balkans and the many people that civilian population that died there, the genocide in Rwanda. When factoring in, I guess, what's legal, what's legitimate, what's normal, can you speak a bit about that?
Well, yes, it's an issue that's paramount in the mind of President Obama's newly confirmed United Nations Ambassador, Samantha Power. Mm-hmm. Samantha Power made her reputation with the book, A Problem from Hell, The Problem of Genocide in the 20th Century, where she looked at Armenia and Rwanda and Kosovo. And essentially it was a cry from the heart, well-reported cry from the heart, for international intervention on humanitarian ground. And although we haven't seen UN Ambassador Power really much, in fact, it's kind of remarkable that we've seen so little of her in public, she, and to a degree, National Security Advisor Susan Rice and some other members of the administration, are humanitarian interventionists. And they make the case that sometimes, if not the full international community, then the United States must use its power to protect innocent civilians. And that is part of the case that's being made here with regard to Syria, although we're hearing much more that it's in the national, cold-blooded national interests of the United States to stop Bashar al-Assad and maybe send a signal to Iran. So this is a controversial idea in national security circles, whether it makes sense to intervene militarily simply to protect the poor and the innocent.
That is interesting that we're not hearing from Samantha Power, the UN representative for the U.S. What do you make of that, Michael?
I don't know what to make of it, honestly. She had a previously scheduled vacation in Ireland, I believe. She has a couple of young kids with her husband, Cass Sunstein, who used to work in the administration. And everybody deserves time off, and et cetera. But honestly, I'm very surprised, and I wonder if there is any meaning to be taken from the fact that she has been nowhere to be seen, in essence, in public on this pre-war debate.
What about the International Criminal Court? And I read some editorials and opinion pieces that could be used to bring Assad and others to the ICC.
Well, that would be a poignant issue for the United States to take up, since it is one of the non-signatory nations to the International Criminal Court. Both Republican and Democratic presidents have declined to sign on to the criminal court, partly out of fear that it would subject U.S. military forces to overseas prosecution. So on the one hand, there'd be sort of a hypocritical argument to be used if we were to go that route. But also, it's not like there's a International Criminal Court SWAT team ready to swoop in and kidnap Bashar al-Assad and take him off to jail and try him. It would be the enforcement of the criminal court would be very, very difficult unless the Syrian government were to fall and there some third party would be able to take custody of the bad actors. So it's an interesting idea. It's just not realistic.
About 30 seconds before we have to say goodbye. So what will you be looking for, watching for over the next week or so?
Well, listen today to the House Foreign Affairs Committee, the hearing that starts at 11:30. The chairman, Ed Royce, a conservative Republican from California, has been skeptical of the administration's argument. There are other skeptics on the committee. But from the statements and the questions that we hear today from Foreign Affairs Committee members, we may get a hint for whether the House will approve this resolution or not.
Michael Doyle, as always, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
My pleasure.
National correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers, where he covers legal and constitutional affairs. We have Amy Smithson waiting in the wings from the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. Continuing education at PAFA invites you to join their community of artists of all ages and levels of experience this fall, featuring classes in drawing, painting, sculpture, and printmaking, pre-college Saturday classes for high school students, and weekend master workshops with renowned artists including Vincent Desiderio and Elizabeth Osborne. Registration is now open. Details online at pafa.edu/ce.
About 10 gunshot victims arrive at Temple University Hospital each week. Trauma chief Dr. Amy Goldberg and youth counselor Scott Charles started the Cradle to Grave program to try to stop the cycle of violence by taking young people at risk into the trauma center and describing the medical realities of gunshot wounds. We'll talk with them and a gunshot victim on the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
All this week, as the consensus over what to do in Syria takes shape, we want you to be a part of it. From constituents all over the country to members of Congress, with plenty of experts each day to keep us grounded. Join the debate at 877-8-MY-TAKE and check out special coverage on Syria this week on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. So what do we know about Syria and its chemical weapons program, what President Assad might do if there's a strike, and how to protect against a chemical weapons attack? Joining us now is Amy Smithson. She's a senior fellow at the Washington, D.C. office of the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies. Her work focuses on the use and reduction of chemical and biological weapons. Wrote a book called Germ Gambits, The Bioweapons Dilemma, Iraq and Beyond. Amy Smithson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
A pleasure to be with you and your listeners.
And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. What do we know about Syria's chemical weapons program?
Well, first of all, Syria's been in the business of chemical weapons for quite some time. Initially, it was dependent on outside assistance from places like Egypt, Russia, Czechoslovakia, more recently from Iran and North Korea. But for the past decade, they have had the capability themselves to manufacture mustard gas and nerve agents. In fact, they've got 4 production facilities, 2 of which are believed to be underground, of course, a research and development site and a couple of storage sites in addition to where they might have deployed these weapons for possible use.
Now, the White House is saying that Assad used sarin gas. We, of course, are waiting for what the UN inspectors determine, but does that make sense to you?
Indeed, it does make sense to me. There was so many videos were uploaded from Syria in the immediate aftermath of the attacks, and one of them in particular convinced me that this was not an event that was faked and that indeed it was exposure to an organophosphate chemical, of which Syria's sarin is in that family of chemicals. And this was a video that lasts about 2 minutes. It's of a young child lying on the floor, apparently in a hospital. You can see the wheels of a gurney. And the child's arms are twitching at different rates. And then the video closes in on the face of the child. And the mouth and the eyes are also twitching at different rates. This is something that can't be coached. It can't be faked. And was one of any number of signs that this was use of chemical agents. And on my part, I'm arguing, quite frankly, that this was indeed an act by the Assad government, because the attacks were executed in the wee hours of the morning when winds are very low and temperatures are cooler, and a military that's trained in how to use chemical weapons effectively knows that's the exact conditions that will encourage a gas to stay over the target. The fact that rockets were the reported delivery systems, the rebels simply don't have that type of a capability. They've got pipe bombs, maybe some do-it-yourself rockets. This has all the hallmarks of a trained military executing this attack.
President Obama, as we all know, has called for some kind of military response to what the regime is alleged to have done. Do you favor that?
Well, there are some things that the Obama administration has done that I think are right on track. One, they very clearly said chemical weapons shouldn't be used, and they're doing their best to try to uphold the norms against the possession and use of chemical weapons. They've also been right in taking the chemical weapons storage sites and facilities off of the target list, because attacking those is, quite frankly, too risky. Most of these sites are located in urban environments, and it could release toxic gases over nearby civilian populations. Where I think they might be misstepping is not taking an advantage of something that the administration has already said it would do, and that is provide chemical defenses to the rebels. Mm. I would argue that they should provide chemical defenses in addition to Syria's civilians. For any number of reasons, this makes sense, because one can't predict whether or not Assad would be angered, cornered, isolated, and quite frankly, willing to use chemical weapons again, and he would be left with those weapons in his hands. If one gives gas masks and instructions in decontamination and nerve agent antidotes and detectors to the civilian population in Syria, then one also begins to take away from Assad the military advantage of using them in the first place, because their effectiveness will not be as great. This is also a point where those who aren't convinced that Assad is the perpetrator of these attacks can perhaps rally around, because if there's one thing everyone would like to see who's watching this horror unfold from afar, it's that death not occur from chemical weapons in Syria or, quite frankly, from any other means of violence.
Let me ask you a practical question. I mean, how would the United States or any outside country or organization get gas masks to the civilian population in Syria?
Well, like many other countries that are members of the Chemical Weapons Convention, which allows the maintenance of chemical defenses, there are chemical corps in these countries that train and use gas masks and have all this equipment. I'm sure they've all got some spares, and I'm sure that this could be sent to the region and funneled into Syria via the humanitarian channels that are currently providing all types of assistance possible to Syrian civilians, and also, quite frankly, the channels that are used to get this assistance to the rebel forces. The Chemical Weapons Convention requires its members to provide assistance in the event that a country is threatened with or undergoes chemical attack. And that very clearly has happened in this instance. Syria is not a member of this treaty, but again, this should be a rallying point for the international community to do something constructive and life-saving.
Let me get, looks like Herb from Glenside, Pennsylvania, to join us. Herb, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning. Go ahead.
I believe the military stocks something called the Nerve Agent Antidote Kit. I think they have an acronym for it. But, again, they're inexpensive, and I'm wondering why those aren't being distributed.
What do you think about that? Sure. Amy Smithson?
I believe you're referring to a Mark Agent Kit, which has atropine and 2-PAM in it and auto-injectors. I've been trained on it. I'm wondering the very same thing. A few weeks ago, a senior official in the State Department announced that the United States would provide and was providing chemical defenses to the rebels. What exactly has happened in the aftermath or prior to that statement, I don't know. Mm. But the United Kingdom has also made a similar announcement. So, again, there are a lot of things that can probably be pulled off shelves to help mitigate the future consequences of chemical weapons use in Syria. So we're on the same line of thought. Why hasn't this happened, and why hasn't more of it happened?
Well, let me see what Faith from Center City, Philadelphia has to say. And Faith, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, hi. My father lived and worked in Iran for a year before the revolution, so I take a particular interest in the Iranian point of view on things. And from the Iranian point of view, we're hypocrites and we're meddling in their affairs once again. The overthrow of Mossadegh has recently been confirmed as a CIA operation. As your previous guest said, Saddam Hussein was helped by us to gas people in Iran in the Iran-Iraq War. 100,000 Iranians died there. And so I'm wondering, at this point, how much of our motivation to bomb Syria would really be about chemical weapons, and how much is just because they're an Iranian client state and we would prefer a different balance of power in the Middle East, which, by the way, we have a fairly bad track record of trying to shift the balance of power in the Middle East.
Faith, I'm going to take you down only because we're losing some of the words there, but Amy Smithson, I'd be curious about your thoughts.
Well, it's hard to say for sure when a public official comes before the microphones whether or not they have given all of the motivations behind a particular decision. In this case, Syria needs to be punished. I follow your train of thought back to Iran, in part because Iran's hands in Syria's chemical weapons program are not clean. They are thought not only to have provided research and development collaboration to the program, but also chemical agent precursors into Syria's chemical weapons program. In this case, I would hope that the Iranian government, given its sad history as a victim of chemical weapons use during the Iran-Iraq war, would come forward with some constructive proposals about how to reduce the harm that could come from repeated use of chemical weapons in the future in Syria. There ought to be some common ground here, even for countries that have political difficulties in military strategic difficulties. And in this case, our sympathies ought to be with the civilians in Syria. Let's focus on the current problem, perhaps not on the problems that lie down the line.
Faith, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Amy Smithson, you have described President Bashar al-Assad of Syria as a thug and also an irrational player. And there's much speculation about if there is some kind of a strike, of course, depending what that target is, what he would or wouldn't do. And I'd just love to have you sort of flesh that out for us.
Well, I think it was Secretary of State Kerry who described him as a thug.
Oh.
I described him as possibly an irrational
player. Okay, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to put words in your mouth there.
It's okay. I think it's there's a history in the region and indeed in other parts of the world of what are called strongmen, Saddam Hussein, Muammar Gaddafi, behaving quite irrationally when faced with overwhelming and really strong outside military opposition in the midst of circumstances where they are defying the opinion of Western countries and even of the entire international community. Case in point would be, again, Saddam Hussein after the invasion of Kuwait, where the international community very clearly got together and said, get out of Kuwait. This is an illegal annexation. Or there will be consequences. And when those consequences were massing for the invasion to boot Iraq out of Kuwait, the response from Saddam Hussein was to toss Scud missiles at Saudi Arabia and at Israel, among other things. So let's not count on Assad to behave rationally. In fact, if there is anything that demonstrates irrational behavior on his part already, it's the fact that the attacks of the 21st were executed when inspectors were in their midst. And a lot of people can't quite wrap their mind around that. Why would he do that? Well, perhaps because he has learned some lessons from next door. Saddam Hussein played a mighty cat-and-mouse game with UN inspectors and, in fact, greatly underestimated their ability to unmask not only his nuclear weapons program, but his chemical his biological weapons program. That's what I wrote about in Germ Gambits. Mm-hmm. And in this case, though, Assad knows that the inspectors can't go out of the hotel without his cooperation, and he also knows, quite frankly, since he's a physician, how long he needed to keep them bottled up in the hotel before they were allowed access to the survivors of these attacks and the opportunity to take samples from them.
Let me see what Roger from Newark, Delaware has to say. Roger, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome.
Ms. Smithson, regarding unintended consequences or unknown unknowns, as Rumsfeld once said, we have two recent examples of that. The surge in Iraq looked like a big success right afterwards, but the place is in total chaos with sectarian killings both ways these days. And with Libya, you have al-Qaeda-related elements that looted Gaddafi's heavy weapons stockpiles and have surface-to-air missiles and all kinds of things that they couldn't have dreamed of a few years ago that are an ongoing danger. So regarding Syria, let's say arm the rebels, they win, they get the hands on some of the chemical weapons stockpiles. aren't some of them al-Qaeda affiliates?
Amy Smithson, and of course there are many unintended consequence scenarios related to Syria. What are your thoughts?
Indeed, and that's one of the tremendous challenges about determining what is the right thing to do in these circumstances. Yes, there are ample public reports that there are al-Qaeda fighters mixed in with the rebel forces, just as there are ample reports that Hezbollah and Hamas are fighting on the side of the Assad regime. These are all elements that, quite frankly, any sane person would not want to give a hand to. And so that's one of the complications of any plan to provide military assistance to the rebels. Would, in fact, some advanced munitions be provided to these undesirable elements? And so that's, again, a reason why I think rallying around the point of saving lives and providing chemical defenses to Syria's civilians and to its rebel forces is a no-brainer thing for the international community and, indeed, our government to do, particularly in advance of any military strikes that would leave Assad with chemical weapons in his hands.
And we're almost out of time here. I mean, are there consequences of doing nothing?
I think the consequences are pretty obvious already. If indeed those earlier incidents were chemical incidents that were from earlier in the year, were the Assad regime testing the waters, what could they get away with? Well, then what they could get away with perhaps may end up being August the 21st if the international community does not react. And I hope that it's not just the United States and a few Western governments that react here. We're seeing indications that the Arab League is interested in participating in a response. To what extent that all works out, I don't know. But again, I think I've identified the common ground here. Let's try to save some lives. Let's try to take the military advantage of using chemical weapons away. And let's get chemical defenses flooding into the hands of Syria civilians.
Amy Smithson, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Senior fellow at the Washington, D.C. office of the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies, author of a book called Germ Gambits, The Bioweapons Dilemma, Iraq and Beyond. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us, and stay with us for the second hour of Radio Times. We'll be right back.